It feels like COVID-19 snuck up on us. At a time when most Americans thought this new virus was happening somewhere else, it was already circulating in U.S. cities, stalking the elderly and medically vulnerable, despite the president's assurances at the time that it would magically disappear. And in the absence of a comprehensive, coordinated federal response, this patchwork of local and state health leaders and scientists realized it would be up to them to figure out how to protect people. From KERA in Dallas, this is Think. I'm Chris Boyd. There are a lot of reasons the U.S. was not prepared with a response that could have slowed the virus in time to save hundreds of thousands of American lives, and we're going to talk about those. There are also lessons to be learned from the ingenuity and persistence of those who tried desperately to make up for what was not happening at the highest levels. Michael Lewis is here to explain. He's a journalist whose books include Moneyball and The Fifth Risk. His new one is called The Premonition, A Pandemic Story. Michael, welcome back to Think.
Thanks for having me back. Not everybody does.
Well, the last time you and I talked, I think, was in 2018. It was about your book, The Fifth Risk. And we talked a little about how, like, a big part of what federal agencies are supposed to do for us involves planning for the future. Not only the future that they can predict, but the possibility of some crisis that hasn't happened yet. Was that when you started worrying about something like a pandemic when you were working on that project?
Yes. So, yes, I mean, the premise of that whole book was, however you think about the federal government, like whatever images pop into your mind and however you're triggered, put those to one side and think of it as a manager of a portfolio of risks, many of them existential, that the private sector is not going to deal with. And in that bucket is pandemic disease. It's like a war. It inherently requires a unified federal response to do it well. And no private entity is going to take it on and solve the problem. So I didn't know when I wrote The Fifth Risk what the risk was that we'd all, you know, regret having neglected. But I figured something would happen. And when this happened, I thought, well, it's kind of the sequel.
So in October of 2019, the Global Health Security Index, sort of infamously at this point, ranked the U.S. number one in the world on health security. Like 5 months later, we're on lockdown. COVID is terrorizing the Northeast in particular. What went wrong with that ranking was the gap between our reputation in the United States and our performance.
Thank you for not alienating the entire state of Texas by mentioning the analogy I bring up in the beginning of the book with the Texas Longhorn football team.
But you can tell that story.
But there is this thing, right? There's this thing that happens in, like, preseason rankings where there's this kind of the way the judgments are made actually are slightly off. And we were being judged in June of 2019 by our capacity. The wealth of resources we have more microbiology labs than anybody. We invented, as the book goes into, pandemic strategy, and yet you know, the games are played, and yeah, guess what, we're not number one. We have 4% of the world's population and 20% of the deaths. Just to put it all in perspective, if we had performed just as well as the average G7 country, there'd be a couple of 100,000 Americans alive today who are not alive. So the gap, like, what is the gap? It's the same kind of error that's made when a football team is judged by the resources of its institution, by the seeming, you know, talent of its players, but nobody's paying attention to how well managed they are or how well coached they are. And you can take an incredibly talented team and turn it into a losing team if you don't know what you're doing. And that's, in so many words, I think that's kind of what happened with our pandemic response. We had the tools and the people to do it really, really well, but we have mismanaged those tools and those people, misallocated them, thought about them the wrong way, put the wrong people in the wrong places. And the stories of these three characters that I tell, it really is the story of three people groping through for solutions inside of a dysfunctional system and describing the various dysfunctions.
So before we get to those stories, I do want to talk to this irony that you mentioned a moment ago, which is that the U.S. sort of invented pandemic strategy. What happened was that President George W. Bush, who was a huge reader, happened to pick up this book in 2005 about the great influenza pandemic. What happened as a result of that?
This is an incredible story. So Bush is on summer vacation, and he is thinking about what's going through his mind at the time. He's got 9/11 in the not too distant past, and he's got Katrina, happening in real time. And he's kind of thinking, and he's then handed this book about what happened in 1918. And he gets back to the White House, and he asks his staff, "What's our plan for a pandemic?" And the staff says, "We don't really have one." And he flipped. I mean, he was upset. And as one of the characters in the book puts it, who was there with Bush at the time, said, "It's amazing how fast the federal government can move if the president is seriously angry." And in a matter of a couple of weeks, a young doctor inside the White House named Rajiv Venkaya has written a 10-page memo that Bush uses to give a speech that causes Congress to allocate $7 billion to pandemic planning. And then they're off and running. And what they do then, I mean, it makes you very proud of our government, what happened back then. Because what they do then is they pull in from relevant agencies that are going to have to maybe deal with a pandemic, but not the CDC, because the White House has concluded that however we're going to think about this problem, it's going to require some new thinking. And we view the CDC as too wedded to old thinking. So, but they pull in really interesting thinkers from different agencies, and they start to noodle on this problem. And there's the book they produce is like, it's mind-numbingly boring, and it goes on for hundreds of pages, and there are lots of little details and big things like how you speed up vaccine production. The speed with which we've generated vaccines in this pandemic, which is the great triumph of this pandemic, dates back to their work. But the question that they really have to noodle on is, what do you do before you have a vaccine? What do you do between the time the pathogen appears and the time you have something you can put in people, a drug? And the answer, because the answer at the time, unbelievably, was there's nothing you can do. That the takeaway from that book Bush read was none of these interventions worked. None of these social interventions. They closed saloons. They stopped church gatherings. They did all this, and still people died. And they hadn't. And these doctors in the White House go back over that record, and they see that's not true. That the death rate in St. Louis was radically less than the death rate in Philadelphia, precisely because St. Louis socially intervened earlier than Philadelphia in relation to the arrival of the disease in the city. And so they spin up a strategy that, and then embedded in the CDC, who then goes and sells it to the rest of the world. And this is the birth of social distancing. And it all happens in this pretty free-form way, with people really thinking hard, doctors really thinking hard about how you save lives in this uncomfortable period between disease and vaccine.
So, Michael, we also meet Dr. Charity Dean in this book, who was chief health officer for Santa Barbara County, later for the state of California. She got interested in super spreaders and what makes them different from other patients because she wanted to keep tuberculosis cases under control. But in some ways, it seems like she had been preparing to respond to a pandemic since she was a kid.
Yes. Thanks for teeing up my favorite character I've ever had. She was raised in a rural, highly religious community that really wanted her to do nothing but be a mom. But she had a passion for science and that she developed very early on, and viruses in particular. When she was in middle school, she hung plastic models of viruses from her ceilings. And when you ask her like why she got so interested, she said she was obsessed with gruesome death. It was like for her horror film was reading books about the bubonic plague. And she goes off and gets her medical degree and a degree in public health. She doesn't know until she kind of stumbles into the Santa Barbara County Clinic, that there is this thing called public health. And the public health officer in Santa Barbara County, like public health officers across the country, have unusual powers to chase communicable disease. And instead of taking a, you know, a very fancy job as a private doctor, she decides instead she's going to devote herself to this. And in her experience, which starts, I think, 2011, 2012, you can start to see the problems this country is going to have with any communicable disease, because the degree of bravery, of courage that's required for her to hunt down tuberculosis outbreaks or close clinic, doctors' clinics where they're injecting patients with dirty needles and giving them Hep C, and the degree of conflict she has to deal with is alarming. Like, no one should have to be as brave as Charity Dean had to be every day she turned up at her job, and nobody knows who she is, and she's got basically no air cover. And she, as she said, after a couple of years of being the local health officer, her mantra became, no one is coming to save you. Hmm. And in particular, the institution that's sort of there at the federal level to come and save the local health officer, the CDC, which is designed, built to, you know, to back up local health officers, was actually a hindrance to her, because they were so scared of controversy and conflict that they would try to get her to back off of whatever she was doing in the moment of battle and wait until they had total certainty about what had happened. But the problem with disease, fighting a disease or fighting a virus, is that by the time you have the data, by the time you have total certainty and clarity, the battle's over. The fog is cleared from the battlefield, and yes, you know what happened, but you didn't control the disease. So she, by a few years into her job, is actually banning CDC officers from her investigations because they get in the way.
So as you mentioned, conventional wisdom was there was really nothing you could do for a pandemic before there was a vaccine or an effective treatment. And folks like Carter Mesher, who you've already mentioned, and Richard Hatchett were like, oh, absolutely, there is. What did they take into account as they were thinking about how the federal government could take steps to save lives in a pandemic before there were any drugs that worked against the infection or any vaccines?
Well, they use this model that they get from the Bob Glass at Sandia to run. First, they kind of run experiments, like what happens in this model if you close the schools. And that was the shocking result, that the role kids played in disease, in the transmission of that particular disease, and how powerful it was to not let them go to school. And Carter Mesher goes to the lengths of going to schools with tape measures to try to understand why. And he realizes that the social density in any given American school is greater than anything else in American life. That if you replicated the social density of a school in a home, in a normal home or in a normal office, it looks comic. It's like people coming out the windows. There's so many people in the space. We shove kids together, and kids also physically interact with each other differently than adults. They don't give each other as much space. So he started to explain why the models were doing what they were doing. And what they do then, once they realize that there are things you can do and the society should prepare to do them, it tells you how much the conventional wisdom was entrenched. It's hundreds of presentations to public health leaders, to anybody who's a stakeholder in this, to the Department of Education, explaining the power of the social interventions. And it's an incredible sales job. They get to the point where they create a new conventional wisdom, and they write the plan for the CDC, who then spreads the plan around the world. So the takeaway is that, you know, there are things you can do, and a lot of people start to believe there are things you can do. And the question is how you do them. And what they would say is they never imagined what we have done with COVID. They imagine that we'd be able to contain it up front, like, say, Australia's contained it up front, and that you would then, it would be targeted interventions, that you would have really good testing, you'd know when there were little outbreaks, and you would respond with the interventions to the outbreaks. You wouldn't just shut down the society. That wasn't the plan. Having said that, what's also true is that because of their work, they're kind of the inventors of social distancing. They become controversial figures because there is a fraction of the society that has framed the whole pandemic as lives versus livelihood. That, oh, what we really should have done is nothing, because then we could have our economy and, maybe a few more people would have died, but there were enormous economic costs to what we did. And I think the fact is that if you don't do anything, if you don't try to mitigate the pandemic, you don't have your economy. What you have is, two or three times the number of people who have died dying, and people aren't going to eat indoors and fly on airplanes. So you get you really it really is a case of not either or, but neither or both. And they didn't imagine that the conversation would be framed as either or. They would think that everybody would understand that we have to control the thing, otherwise we don't have an economy.
So, Michael, Charity Dean is concerned that the CDC is sort of observing and reporting on the spread of the pandemic, but not taking concrete steps to slow that spread. Her other concern is that less aggressive public health officers around the country are waiting to sort of take their marching orders from CDC, and those marching orders are not coming.
Correct. And in mid-January, she's got a kind of a bead on what's going on in Wuhan. So you look at her whiteboard, pictures of her whiteboard from the time that she kind of has sort of projected out exactly what's going to happen in the United States. And she finds herself, and this is again where the story gets more complicated than just a failed federal response. Even in the state of California, which has itself enormous resources and the capacity to respond to a pandemic all by itself, she's shut down. Her boss forbids her from using the word pandemic. They make her erase her whiteboard so nobody looks at this alarming math showing the spread of disease in California. She's not invited anymore to the meetings in which people are discussing the possibility of having to respond to this thing. So she's isolated for the for the first kind of 6 weeks of the thing, and that time was tragic because there are things that could have been done. And in particular, what could have been done and what she wanted to do was spin up a lot of testing labs around the state. It wouldn't have saved the country, but it might have done a lot more for California, because she had a sense that the CDC was going to mismanage it. And this is an example that of like how I work, that I didn't go into this thinking, this is a book about the CDC. I went into thinking, this is a book about these characters and their experience. They are kind of like the best eyes through which to see this thing we've been living through. And the way that her relentless disappointment with the Centers for Disease Control over a decade leads her to see just know in advance how they're going to respond when this happens, I found like spine tingling, that I would not have guessed it, but she knew. She knew exactly what was going to happen.
Meanwhile, you have the president of the United States at the time saying, you guys are on your own.
You enabled, I guess is probably the best way to put it, the Defense Production Act yesterday, but you didn't pull the trigger on it.
No, because we hope we're not going to need that.
What's the rationale for not doing that?
First of all, governors are supposed to be doing a lot of this work, and they are doing a lot of this work. The federal government's not supposed to be out there buying vast amounts of items and then shipping. We're not a shipping clerk.
Michael, help us understand how much can governors and local health departments do, and how much of this sort of thing, especially when it comes to acquiring sufficient amounts of PPE and testing supplies, how much has to fall to the federal government?
What he said is a bit like saying the Russians are invading. You governors, get your armies together. Hmm. Montana, guard that border.
They're probably ready in Montana, but yeah.
What he triggered, and which the book, that part of the book describes, is this free for all with Americans competing with Americans to buy stuff at inflated prices from China, and much of the stuff is like phony. It's fraudulent. It's fake masks and fake swabs, and that we didn't do that at the federal level was very expensive and inefficient. The federal government buying it for everybody and distributing it. On the level of the supplies, on the level of like the governors are supposed to be figuring out how we respond to a pandemic. Well, you know, is Mississippi really going to figure out how to respond to a pandemic? I just, you know, the big, you and I are in states that probably could. We didn't have the resources. Texas and California and New York and a few others probably kind of could, in theory, handle the problem just in on their own turf, but they weren't expecting to have to, and that's a huge disadvantage. And it creates too much room for debate when we don't have time for debate, when with too much time for inaction when there's no time for inaction. And to me, what was just unbelievable was that when you went and looked at who did what in the early days, which states took action that saved lives in the early days, you could map the actions that were taken onto the social relationship of this group of doctors that call themselves the Wolverines that are trying to save the country, this kind of shadow force. It was who they happened to know. So that one of them happens to work very closely with the Maryland governor. Another one is good friends from medical school with the health director of the state of Ohio. And another one knows Charity Dean in California. And those are the three states that shut down first. And they shut down because of conversations they had with this group of doctors who actually knew what was happening. And that our response is that patchwork and haphazard. And that on the side, we have this thing called the Centers for Disease Control that's doing nothing. It's breathtaking. It's so breathtaking that it gives me hope, right? It's such a preposterous response. There's no way we do this again. There's no way we don't fix it. It's so obviously glaringly bad.
So, Michael, we're not out of the woods yet in this country, and there's a full-blown crisis in places like India and Brazil. What do we need to be doing right now to begin preparing for the next pandemic while we're still trying to fix the one we have?
Can I be God?
Please.
Right, so here are the things. We don't have a public health system. We have 3,000 charity deans, and they're not networked properly. They're not empowered properly. So the just creating a sense, all right, it's not going to be top down. It's going to be bottom up. Like the local health officer is the important unit, and they need to be resourced and networked, and they need to be recognized so that they have kind of a social political authority when bad things happen. So that's like the first thing that you do. But the other thing is there are things we should be doing now in relation to the current pandemic, that both to reduce the threat of variants jumping the vaccines and prepare for what's coming next. And the big thing is using a technology we have, genomic sequencing of the virus, everywhere and thoroughly, so we know what's coming.
Michael Lewis is a journalist whose books include Moneyball and The Fifth Risk. The new one we've been talking about today is The Premonition, a pandemic story. Michael, it's always a pleasure. Thanks for making time for us.
Thanks for having me.
Think is a production of KERA in Dallas. Our team includes Stephen Becker, Paige Phelps, Ana Perez, Nilofer Arsala, and Micaela Rodriguez. Our interns are Madison Hurd, Sriya Reddy, and Rolando Hernandez. You can listen to Think wherever you get your podcasts. As always, I'm Chris Boyd. Have a great day.